This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
I have got to update that intro. It's been ending with Trump hugging the flag in a really creepy way for far too long. We need to figure something out. You're always on the videos. What do we put in there? Something that's creepy. Maybe people can tweet us something.
Is it, you think I should, I'm sorry. Jesus. It's been a
it's
week.
Early in the
I'm
morning.
Sorry, you guys.
It's early in the morning. You look very nice, though.
Well, thank you. I was a little bit too many blues. I don't know. I was worried about that.
They're different shades, though. With your head covering, you wouldn't be allowed into a Houston school, but other than that, as a preview of a story.
Well, you can have up to two. You just can't have three.
Yeah.
Two different tones is fine.
So if you have an idea of a really embarrassing or creepy video that could go with that, just let me know. I'm John DeRola, Jared Jackson. We got a big show for you. It's a little bit different of a show. We've got two awesome guests who are going to be joining us. We're going to be talking about a number of different issues of man, my mind is not together either.
Wow, it's pretty early.
So anyway, Denver City Council, one of the candidates running in that race is going to be on our race, on our show in just a little bit. Also, we wanted to talk to Debbie Nathan about legal trouble that's coming towards Good Samaritans who are helping out migrants crossing the border. Early this week, we weren't able to make it happen, so she is going to be joining us on the show today. We've got interesting poll of how millennials feel about their economic future. We're going to break that down, and it's going to be a little bit depressing. And we finally have the return of garbage people. Steve King spoke. And thus, he's going to go in the garbage can a little bit later on. So we'll be doing that too. But we're going to be starting off on a bit different note. It's a weird one. Buckle up. Twitter came to the White House, and obviously, there's a lot of different issues with Twitter that have an influence on politics and society and all of that. Lots, I guess, they could talk about with Donald Trump and the White House. Instead, they talked about one thing in particular. So this is according to the Washington Post, had a source inside of the meeting who said, a large percentage of the meeting, which included senior White House officials such as Trump's social media director, Dan Scavino, was spent addressing the subject of real Donald Trump's follower count. The president stated his belief that he had lost some of his roughly 59 million followers in anti-Trump, anti-conservative Twitter purges, according to a source familiar with the meeting. So you have arguably one of like the two or three most important social media platforms in the world, which obviously has had a huge impact on politics around the world for some time. You have the CEO, Jack Dorsey, in the White House. And Trump is like, why am I losing Twitter followers? And that's apparently what a large percentage of the whole meeting was about. And Trump, he did bring evidence to this meeting. He said that he had heard from fellow conservatives who had lost followers for unclear reasons as well. Oh. And so that's what he said. Here is how the CEO of Twitter responded to the concerns of the most powerful man in the world. Dorsey, this is Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, had to explain to the president that like other Twitter users, real Donald Trump periodically loses followers when the site deletes fake or bot accounts. Dorsey even said he himself had lost followers as a result of Twitter's efforts to delete fake accounts. By the way, in one of those purges, every once in a while, Twitter updates the way that they scan for fake accounts, and then they get rid of those people. And sometimes really embarrassing for certain high profile people, how many they lose. In one of them, by the way, you have Donald Trump, current president, you have Barack Obama, former president. Trump lost 200,000 followers. Obama lost 2 million. And yet I've never seen a right winger talking about shadow banning and Twitter like censoring politicians mention the fact that it was 10 times as impactful on Barack Obama as it was on Donald Trump. But White House meeting, that's what he's concerned with.
Well, the first thing they would have to admit is that Obama had more followers in the first place, which again,
it's true.
If I'm the president of the United States, first of all, I'm not sure, maybe there's a real political world-changing reason to have a meeting with the Twitter CEO in the White House about other things. Uh-huh. The whole time I was trying to figure out what else should they be talking about in this meeting. And I came up with nothing because there's probably more important things to do from that desk, number one. After that, so let's talk about my followers. It is a good chance, Trump, that there's people who said, I'm sick of hearing this guy's BS. I'm tired of reading his exclamation points. I'm tired of seeing his all caps tweets early in the morning. Mm. I'm seeing it on news sources anyway. I might as well get rid of this guy. There's people who do that too, by the way. Yeah. You know, there's people who get offended by the things you say and say, you know what? I'm tired of following this guy. I need to cleanse my life. It happens. Mm. Sometimes people on other platforms like Facebook say, hey, you guys, I'm taking a social media hiatus. I'm gone for the month. Don't get offended. They're doing it for their own, for their health. Yeah. So there's many reasons people may get rid of it. But of course, in broad numbers, it's the fake account thing. It's not embarrassing. Calm down. Everybody's mm-hmm. got some. That's the way it works. I can tell when they start following me. Mm-hmm. I see them. They have zero followers, or they have two, or they have the Twitter eggs, which aren't eggs anymore. But it's pretty obvious. Just relax.
Yeah.
Nobody is worried about this except for you. The other things that you're doing is what you need to start worrying about.
Yeah, exactly. Look, people do buy followers. That is a thing that has happened. It seems like it's harder since there's been multiple years of efforts to stop that from happening. But then also, bot networks will simply follow you and spread your content for propagandistic reasons. There's all sorts of people inside of the US and internationally that like what Donald Trump is saying because of the damage that it's doing. And so they help to amplify that. And so he loses some followers as a result of that. Doesn't mean that he was going out and buying them. He just happened to get them. But I compared the effect that it had on Obama and Trump. And I'm not the only person who is interested in the disparity in followers between Obama and Trump. Trump is too. Trump has apparently repeatedly griped to associates about how Obama has had more Twitter followers than he has, even though by Trump's own assessment, he is so much better at Twitter than Obama is. It's not surprising at all. And by the way, I'm not just saying as a progressive Democrat, it's not surprising Donald Trump is terrible. No. Donald Trump specifically tailors his message to hard right, generally American people. There are some, you know, like hard right, alt-right, white supremacists in Europe that probably like his message too. But it, by its very nature, is not going to travel very well. Whereas Obama, whether you like it or not, whether you think he's deserved or not, has presented himself as sort of a beacon of rationality and hope and whatever the other branding is. That is appealing in a lot of different countries, which is why I'm sure Obama has a much bigger following outside of the US. And that's why he has like close to double the followers that Trump does.
There's things that Obama would say that people are interested in reading. That they're like, oh, I wonder what Obama would say about this. Whether you like him or not, whether or not you're a progressive Democrat or you're some guy in Australia, you're like, oh, I wonder what the former president of the United States has to say about this. I should follow him on Twitter. Then every time he says something, I can see it. No one's curious about what Trump might say about something, about some disaster outside of the fact. I wonder what hate he's gonna throw that way.
Yeah.
We already know it's gonna be hateful. We already know it's gonna be over the top and bombastic. So there's no more surprises left in store. There's a certain number of people who just don't want your toxicity in their life. Simple.
Yeah, I don't even know why I follow him. But I do.
I don't.
I probably shouldn't.
I followed this with the POTUS handle. I'm sorry, the POTUS handle on Twitter. I follow previous presidents, and it continues and it jumps to the next president. That one I follow of his, but his personal one, I can't do it. I mean, the thing is, I see it all the time anyway. You don't have to follow him. Is the easy part?
Yeah. Okay. So look, outside of the direct concerns of Donald Trump, I do think that this is important. This conversation that Twitter had with Donald Trump because of the overall conservative messaging around social media and the supposed victimization. So we will return to that topic, but we do have to take our first break. When we come back, candidate for Denver City Council, District 9, will be joining us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of The Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We are joined now on the Damage Report by candidate for Denver City Council, District 9, Candy Sitabaka. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you on. And so let's talk about your candidacy. What led you to want to join Denver City Council?
Denver's changing a lot here, and it's becoming a city for the wealthy. And I lost a lot of people in our community. We were pushed out through eminent domain. I live three blocks away from a major highway expansion, and that catalyzed my involvement in some of the activism here in the city. And then it just snowballed into a city council race.
So it's interesting because the first issue you bring up is actually related to several I want to ask you about. But the eminent domain that you're talking about obviously for the people who are pushed out, that's absolutely terrible. In general, across the city, is that an issue that people are paying attention to? How does the community actually respond to those sorts of efforts?
Yeah, it's become a major issue because the eminent domain abuse has gone beyond just this project. And so we're seeing eminent domain used as a tool to displace many people for many projects throughout the city. And people are starting to talk about it in a way I have never seen before in my life. But we're also getting pushed out by the artificial inflation and the cost of living here and stagnant wages.
So obviously, I think most people watching this are going to understand the stagnant wages and all that. But the artificial increase in the cost of living, explain that to us.
Yeah, I lived in DC for about 6 years, and I came back to find that the cost of living was the same in Denver as it was in DC. You can't make the same amount of money, but within a year or two, people went from being able to pay about $500 for rent to $15,000 to $2,000 for the same exact space.
Wow. Okay. And I can understand how that would be devastating, having lived in areas with much lower, much higher rent through the course of my life. Gentrification, I've read, is a significant problem in Denver as it is in many cities across the country. If you make it into the city council, what do you believe that you would be able to do to help deal with that?
Well, a lot of people don't fully understand gentrification and how it's not about individual to individual displacement. It's about a package of policies that reorient cities away from serving their people to places that generate profit for the wealthy and for corporations. And so I think we have to pinpoint the policies that have been put in place over the last few decades to create the context we're living in that we're calling gentrification and dismantle those one by one. There's no silver bullet, but the primary function of city council is land use and zoning. And so that is the way you decide where we put people in a city, how people live, what kind of businesses come into those spaces. And so land use and zoning are going to be my top priority when I'm trying to address the issue of gentrification in this city.
And so I guess it is related to that. When you're talking about the expansion of highways and that pushing more people out, that is one way that cities have responded to increasing populations in the past. And I've seen that when I lived in Austin, that was an issue. In terms of transportation policy in a city growing like Denver, how would you like to see that put into place?
Well, we've kind of watched globally highways, superhighways, be taken down. We know that when they came in, it was after World War II, superhighways served a very specific purpose, and it would be to get military vehicles through our country, in and out of cities. And so now that that is no longer the need for them, and our planet is essentially on fire, we know that incentivizing use of cars is probably not the best types of solutions to be implementing at this point in time. And so getting highways out and figuring out how to connect our street grids, how to do multimodal transportation in a way that works for people should be the focus of transportation innovation nowadays. I would love to see our city rely more on the city and not federal funding or state funding to do public transportation, because with that kind of reliance on that type of revenue stream, urban contexts will never get what they need as far as public transit goes.
So I believe it's the candidate that you were running against actually had sponsored an urban camping ban that effectively obviously targets homeless people living in cities like Denver. What do you think about that camping ban, and should it be reversed?
Well, that's one of the reasons that I'm running against him. He has been in office for 8 years, and that camping ban essentially made it illegal to be poor or homeless in the city of Denver. And that's a trend that we're seeing across the country. And we often do that to populations that we don't find desirable, that we want to hide. And we've used that piece of policy to pretend like we've addressed our homeless situation when we've really just pushed homelessness to a different part of the area and out of the backyards of businesses. And so I think that it's cruel, it's inhumane, and it's a civil rights issue, a human rights issue. And there's currently a ballot initiative right now called Initiative 300, The Right to Survive, which is aiming to repeal that camping ban. There's a lot of money being dumped into the opposition of 300. I'm the only candidate in my race that's supporting 300. And that, I think, needs to come with a layer or several layers of real policy solutions for homelessness.
So, Kenny, so when it comes to the homelessness problem in that particular one, there's the landscaping of like LA. It happens in cities like LA too. Where are these, and we talk about where a lot of those homeless folks are pushed out and end up, you know, being forced to certain areas. What's the landscape of the areas that these homeless folks end up getting pushed to in a city like Denver? Because it's different in every city, you know.
Well, the interesting thing about what camping bans represent is a modern form of redlining, right? So we have to acknowledge the intersection of race and class when it comes to the people who are homeless. And we do have a big chunk of people who are people of color that are homeless. And so when we're moving them out of cities, out of the desirable spaces, out of business areas of rampant consumerism, what we're trying to do is bust up the communities because they do typically travel in community, and we're trying to scatter them everywhere. So right now, the complaint is that they're in neighborhood parks and neighborhood alleys surrounding the downtown area. But I've witnessed them trying to go anywhere where they feel like they won't be targeted. So I've seen people living on the river. I've seen people living in the furthest corners of town, in places that they wouldn't expect anyone to want to visit.
Kenny Sitabaka, candidate for Denver City Council, District 9. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
We're gonna take a short break. We come back, a principal at a Houston area school has instituted a new dress code, not for the kids, but for the parents, after this. So we've heard about dress codes at elementary schools and high schools before, and they tend to be controversial, but we've got one that I think is even more controversial than usual, and that is because it doesn't target the kids, it targets their parents when the parents come to the school. So this is James Madison High School, who is gonna turn away parents who show up to school wearing pajamas, hair rollers, leggings, or certain other items of clothing, including bonnets. Principal Carlotta Outley Brown said, "No one can enter the building or be on the school premises wearing a satin cap or bonnet on their head for any reason. You also cannot wear a shower cap of any kind in the building." And we've got more details on that, but that's a lot. So, Jer, what do you think about, you have a kid, you go to school for, you drop them off, school functions, meetings.
I have a self-induced dress code when I go to my kid's school, because there was one time that I just forgot myself, because you know there's a lot of TYT branded shirts and apparel that we have.
What did you wear?
I've worn one there once.
What did it? Can you say it? Maybe you can't say it. Don't say anything.
I don't know if it's still the words. But
then no, you can't say it.
It's the Richie Rich one. It's the play off the Richie Rich.
You wore that to school?
I was coming to work right afterwards, right? Come on.
I love that shirt, and I have never felt comfortable wearing it.
There's the Chump one, with Trump's face on, a little bit blurred and everything. Mm-hmm. And I've worn that in general out and around. But So that day I just kind of forgot. So the whole time in assembly, like morning assembly, every child is there, and the part where it's written is like this low. So the whole time I had a low cross of arms. Usually a cross is up here. I was down here like this.
Yeah.
Just because I realized, like, you know, not because I'm avoiding any kind of conversation with anyone. It's just because I didn't want kids later to start asking, hey, so there was a dad there. He was wearing something with the word on it. And then so I don't want that conversation to be led because of me. Just because I would like to avoid that myself.
Yeah, now, but that's you choosing.
Yeah, exactly.
This is everybody has to abide by this.
And it's been,
or by the way, in terms of consequences, let me read one more graphic. So where did this come from? Madison High's dress code was established shortly after KPRC-TV in Houston reported that a parent attempting to enroll her child was asked to leave because of her attire, which included a headscarf and a t-shirt dress.
I mean, that's a
t-shirt dress, I think, is like a really, like, it's like t-shirt material, I think, but I think it's a dress.
Yeah.
I have never worn one. But so this is not a personal choice thing. This is you can't come and try to get your kid in school, try to better their education if you are not dressed to my standards.
Yeah, so it sounds like the pushback is based off, is saying that this is a bit of a classist approach. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, classist or racist, depending.
Yeah.
Now, in this particular case, for context, the principal is black.
Right. Okay. So this is the thing. There's sections of the black community. I'm gonna educate you guys on this. Mm-hmm. There's black folks. Every black person doesn't think the same. Crazy how that works.
Despite
what conservatives tell you, black folks don't get a daily email telling us how to be. We're all different. So there's some black folks like this principal who's like, you know what, I don't like, and maybe she is specifically targeting maybe some black parents because that's the visual a lot of people get in their head of maybe someone wearing a bonnet or rollers or just rolling through in their morning, because that's been like, it's one of those stereotypes of black folks. Sometimes they come in with their rollers still in there because their hair ain't, they're ready to get the hair done for the day, and it's only 7 a.m.
Yeah.
So.
Brooke made a similar point about the timing of when you drop off the kids and when you get ready as well.
Yeah, so the thought process, maybe even from this black principal, is I don't like this representation of my people. It's not necessarily hateful, but it is still putting limits on grown folks and what they can do and what they want to do with their lives. But she's concerned more about how we look in open society. There's some black folks that get embarrassed and like, hey, you know what? Let's stop looking like that in front of other folks. And as others go, hey, if other folks have a problem with me, that's their problem.
Yeah.
So it's a division in the thought process. So I can see the problem this principal has with it, but it's a little too far to tell people what to do. That's still a controlling action.
And it doesn't seem to be universally popular. One of the parents, Tamiko Miller, said, I really think it was discriminatory, the language that was used. It was demeaning.
Absolutely.
And I'm African American, and if it's misty outside and I have a hair bonnet on, I don't see how that's anyone's business. Agreed. I think you can wear pretty much whatever hat you want. Look, there are hats I don't like in this country. There's hat I don't like in this country. You still probably get to wear it though if you want to. If the kid's wearing it, that's weird in elementary school. And so Zeph Capo, president of the Houston Federation of Teachers, said, I'm sorry, this principal may have plenty of money and time to go to the hairdresser weekly and have her stuff done. Who are you to judge others who may not have the same opportunities that you do? Having a wrap on your head is not offensive. It should not be controversial. Although it's also not a new policy for this principal who previously had been a principal at an elementary school and had a similar policy there. So look, I'm sure she'll explain it at some point and she'll try to put a good spin on it. But in other contexts where people have instituted this sort of thing, it definitely reads as classist and racist that it's targeting certain sorts of people. And like even the particular specifics in this, one of the things you can't wear are leggings. Like, you think they're gonna institute that in like Santa Monica?
Mm-mm.
Like, I don't go to a Santa Monica school, but I'm imagining every mom dropping off her kids is wearing leggings. Like, it's targeting specific sorts of things. You can't have ripped jeans. They're still jeans, it's still pants. She's not teaching the class.
Yeah, in general, a lot of times these rules, my wife works at a school, and they have these things, no tattoos visible, no certain, it's like no form-fitting jeans, all this stuff. Like, you're supposed to wear a shawl. And she was very concerned about this at first because she got tattoos, right? Uh-huh. And then it was there for a week, and after a week, she goes to normal dress, and then nobody says anything.
Yeah.
Because that's generally how it works. But it sounds like this particular principal is a little hardcore, considering she's been continuing this policy from previous stints as a principal. And she's got to learn how to let go a little bit. It's okay, I understand. That's your preference. You don't want, let's go ahead and say it. I'm not saying this is her, but some folks think this way. They go, we don't want white folks seeing us like this. calm down. Who cares how white folks see you? Now, I'm putting that on her. I'm not saying she's necessarily saying that, but people who generally don't want things seen a certain way, that's a line that we hear sometimes.
Yeah. We should get the principal on, interview about this. We'll work on that. Okay, let's turn to one other topic in this block. New poll shows that despite the rough state of the economy, you know, we're still harmed by the Great Recession of just about a decade ago. Millennials, many of them, still think that things are going to work out really well for them economically. More power to the optimism, I will say, although we're going to add some context to that. More than half of American millennials, that's those born between 1981 and 1996, so yes, I am technically a millennial. And I have a little buffer. Believe that they will one day be millionaires. One in five think they will be there by the age of 40. So that, I think the second part's much more significant. It's one thing if you think that you will be a millionaire someday. And look, honestly, if you can save and you have, you know, a 401k or whatever, you get some sort of job if you're lucky enough to do that, and you just save for decades and decades, yeah, you probably will have that kind of money when you're 60 or 70. You can retire and have some money if you are able to save consistently for half a century. Doing it by the age of 40, that's a different statement. That's saying, no, I'm not gonna retire a millionaire. I'm gonna be rich. I'm gonna be driving around a Ferrari when you wanna be driving around a Ferrari, not like 80-year-old guy driving around a Ferrari.
Yeah.
So 20% think that they will be a millionaire by the age of 40. What do you think about that?
I think everyone thought this way. I mean, at least from my perspective, because that's what we sell folks in America. It's the American dream. Oh man, you can do anything if you have the drive and the talent and the skill and the smarts and know how to do it. You can do it. Now, I would love for the next question to be from many of these millennials is how? Like there was plans. I had plans to be a millionaire too, but I had a thought process. I had a goal that I thought I would get to. Little did I know, I wasn't interested in pursuing that. You know?
Yeah.
So I would have been bored with my life. Yeah, it's true. There's things you could get into that will get you there, and you may get to that status, but you may not be very happy with your life. There's plenty of people who are millionaires who are like, I wish I didn't have to do this every day.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. But or there's others who just think, hey, I went to this school, so I'm gonna make tons of money. That's not the way it always works. So it depends on way the person's thinking and what their goal, what their process is to get there.
Yeah, and so for me, the sort of like dark underpinning of this story is not that millennials are overly optimistic. I want them to have that optimism. I want them to think that they can, you know, achieve whatever they want. The issue is that they dwell in a system that has made it not just difficult to become a millionaire, but far harder than it was for their parents or their grandparents. And so let's take a look at this chart. It's gonna show median net worth for the dark bars are 20 to 35 year olds. Lighter is 25 to 35 year olds. And you're seeing it stretch back to the very late 80s there. And you can see that if you go all the way to the right, the youngest people, 20 to 35 year olds, have, it looks like, close to half the net worth as the same age people back in 1995. So decades of time have gone by, but not decades of progress, not in terms of making it so that people are better off at the same point in their life. It's actually more difficult, and yet they do still have that optimism. I just wish that the system was set up in a way that could make good on that optimism, that if they are responsible, that they could have this sort of success.
There's this thought, and like I was saying, we're getting sold this American dream of opportunity. You're gonna do whatever opportunity you can have. You have the utmost opportunity, you just have to take it. There's plenty of times that the opportunity is not given to you, that when you pursue the right things are taken away from you, or you're limited in what you can do. And those don't factor in. You go, I'm not gonna be that guy. But if, as we know, the numbers of the very few numbers of ultra rich people in the country, it's getting smaller and smaller. So it's impossible for everybody to be that, you know?
Yeah.
For a reason.
And look, I mean, one of the strains running through the purpose of this show week after week is, I mean, it's sort of, it slides into this very naturally. Like, if you wanna be a millionaire, good. There is still time. But what you need to do is not just make the right economic choices, because many of those choices are being made for you. If you want to get the right sort of job, likely you're gonna be crushed by student loan debt and then you're gonna be paying it off for literally decades. If you don't get a home financially, you're gonna be screwed. And unfortunately, it's looking more and more like if you ever do get a home, you're gonna be screwed a different way. And so all of the major economic choices that you can make, it is far, far more difficult for them to actually benefit you. So you need to make the right choices economically, but you also need to make the right choices politically. The system is set up to screw you over, so screw over the system. Elect the right politicians, support the right policies, and maybe that, as well as some fiscal responsibility on your own part, can lead in 20 or 30 years to you having the financial success that you dream one day you will.
So take on 3 roommates until you're 40, and you might get
this. That would help too. Also, apparently don't have kids. Apparently they're expensive.
No, don't do that.
Yeah. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, people, good people, like with the right thoughts in mind, they're going to the border, they're helping out migrants, and unfortunately they are suffering legally for it. So we'll be breaking that down after this. You probably read recent reports of militia members basically kidnapping people at the border. So yes, some of our worst in America are heading down there to get involved in the situation. But at the same time, there are good people, good Samaritans trying to help these migrants out in a variety of different ways. And unfortunately, in some cases, it does lead to legal problems for them. And joining us now to break this down is writer for The Appeal, Debbie Nathan. Welcome to The Damage Report.
Hi, nice to be here.
Glad to have you here. So before we get into the consequences, what are the sorts of way that these Good Samaritans are helping out migrants?
In Arizona, people are going out into the desert where for the last, since 1998, over 7,000 people have died in the desert from not having water and from the heat. And so people are going out and leaving food and leaving water and sometimes sheltering people who they find that are ill. And people are, you know, if they see somebody sick on the side of the road in Texas, there was a woman who gave a ride to a young girl who was dying, literally dying. So, I mean, people are doing what they do normally, just as part of the human impulse to help people in trouble. That's what's going on the border as well.
And so in terms of the consequences that they can face, what sorts of charges are being used against these Good Samaritans? And where is it most likely to happen? Are there some states that are more litigious in this fashion than others?
Well, these are federal charges. So the charges that people are getting are what's called harboring, smuggling and harboring. Mm-hmm. So that's one. Another one is basically, defacing or littering public lands, but when you leave water or food out, like canned foods. But the cases that I've been looking at have been where people are accused of felony smuggling and harboring. And there was a case recently in West Texas out in the desert where actually a fairly prominent official, the county attorney of a county called Jeff Davis, and she's also the city attorney of Marfa, was driving down the road at night, and she saw some people who clearly looked like they were in distress. They were making like signs, please help us, stop. She stopped, and it was two young brothers, and the teenage sister was at the side of the road, and she was very seriously ill. They'd been walking for 10 days and for 2 days with no food or water, and her body was eating up her muscles because of the situation they'd been in. So Teresa Todd was the name of the county attorney, and she just put them in the car, and she actually called up ICE and Border Patrol because she had friends who were in those agencies. And then the sheriff came by and stopped her car and called up the Border Patrol. And as a result, she is facing charges. She hasn't been charged, but she's facing charges of harboring and smuggling. There's another case that I know about that goes back a couple of years ago where a woman in South Texas was asked, she was filling up her car with gas, and a couple of very young men asked for a ride, and they looked very destitute. And she's just like, she actually calls herself a Good Samaritan. She said she always tries to do good deeds, and she wasn't afraid of them, and she put them in her car, and she was stopped by state troopers and accused of smuggling. She was kept for about 6 hours while they investigated, and I think they looked at like the gas station video and saw that there was no money exchanging hands, and it clearly looked like there was no deal going on, and they let her go. But she told me that she will never do a Good Samaritan deed again for somebody. And it's very sad to hear something like that because, again, I mean, these are basic human impulses that we have to help people in need. Yeah. And when people are being intimidated, that is not a good thing.
So you mentioned that these are federal charges. So I'm certainly curious, in the past couple of years since Donald Trump was sworn in, has there been like pressure to do more of these sorts of charges, or is the situation effectively similar to how it was before Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I had these stories that I was collecting, and I decided to look at the statistics, particularly because in June of 2017, the Trump administration ordered federal prosecutors to focus on this particular statute and focus on prosecutions. So by 2018, there was a jump. I looked at statistics. I saw that, like, from 2015 to 2018, which was the last time I could get figures, that's the last fiscal year, there was a jump of about a third in these prosecutions. Like, they went up from about 3,500, a little less than 3,500, to more than 4,500, which was almost a third jump. And most of that jump occurred actually right after, like in the fiscal year right after this directive went out. So it does seem like there's more pressure and more prosecutions.
Are there any efforts, or I mean, is it even legally possible for either localities or states to pass laws that might help to protect Good Samaritans in these situations?
I don't know. I haven't heard about any efforts to do that. I think that it would be, there would be a big pushback from the feds, and I don't really know how states can respond to federal law. I think the fact that it's federal would probably make that quite difficult.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. And you mentioned talking to a person who said that they were not going to personally get involved in these situations before, but I know that even if there's concern about some sort of, you know, criminal issues, a lot of people do want to help. Is there anything that you would suggest to people that might be a legally safer way to assist these people?
You know, in Arizona, I'm not sure that there is. These are very remote areas. And the people who are willing to go out and give this kind of assistance are not just like the people that I saw in South Texas that are just driving down the road to pick up some milk from the convenience store. I mean, these people are very dedicated, and I think that's one reason they're being targeted. You know, in these situations that I saw in Texas, could they call up 911 and ask for an EMT? Could they stand by the side of the road, maybe? Possibly just stand by the side of the road and try to give first aid, you know, and call up 911 and just say that there's a medical emergency. Mm. You know, I suppose that might work. yeah, it's a very odd situation because we usually consider, I mean, states all have Good Samaritan laws. You know, you stop, you help somebody in distress. Yeah. You cannot be, you know, held liable if something bad happens while you're trying to do that. You know, you can stop if you're not a doctor, and you can try to help and not be liable for the person's medical condition. It's a very unusual situation, I think. It's a situation that's specific to what's going on the border now and to what's going on with the pressures from the Trump administration. So again, I mean, I think that we need political solutions to this. Possibly they might help before legal solutions do, or legal workarounds.
Well, I agree. It is a unusual situation, and one that's not talked about very much, which is why I appreciated your writing and your reporting on this issue. Debbie Nathan, writer for The Appeal, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Steve King goes into the trash can after this. Recently, Steve King was talking about his own personal travails since he declared that he doesn't understand why white nationalist or white supremacy are bad words. And as a result of what he said about that, it's time for another Garbage People. So if you haven't seen him in a while, this is Steve King. Steve King is an interesting guy with a long history of saying and doing really questionable things that all coincidentally have to do with race and stuff. And so he recently was at a town hall, and there were at least 3 to 6 other people there, a very popular guy. And a woman asked about how, like, we have all these problems as a country, and she thinks that we need to pray to deal with it. And this is the direction he took it in. He responded saying, "For all that I've been through, and it seems even strange for me to say it, but I'm at a certain peace, and it is because a lot of prayers for me. That's fine." But then he says, "And when I had to step down to the floor of the House of Representatives and look up at those 400 and some accusers, you know, we just passed through Easter and Christ's passion, and I have better insight into what he went through for us, partly because of that experience." And if it seems like he is saying that him being censured for defending white supremacy is like being crucified, that's what he's saying. It's like being whipped through the streets, dragging a cross, and dying on that cross.
Usually that's a joke when someone's so self-important about something that happened to them that they brought on themselves, and then they go on to say, or they'll complain, oh my God, I can't believe you guys are censuring me for being a piece of garbage. And then someone goes, oh, so how does it feel? You're on the cross now. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to say that sarcastically at someone. Yeah. Hey, you want to get off the cross now? Instead, he throws himself on and thinks that's a good thing.
He's one of the worst people in elected office, and I really hoped that he would get knocked out the last time. Like, that obviously would not be a solution to any of our problems having to do with race, either in the current day or historically. But it would at least be an indication that when they are, like, when they bring to themselves the focus of all of this concern, when they want to make clear to you of exactly what they think about different groups in America by their public statements, and we're gonna read a few endorsing candidates that are out and out Nazis and all of that, at least they might be knocked off. But no, he avoided losing his job. He got censured by the House, that's true, which means that for literally decades of racist statements, racist actions, racist policies, he got the same consequence that Ilhan Omar got for a tweet.
Yeah.
That's the best we could do in America.
And then they complained still, like, we did what we're gonna do with Republican leadership. We did what we're gonna do with Steve King. Now you guys have to do the same thing to Ilhan Omar. It's a game to them. It's like, we're supposed to equate all of this so that we can lessen the actual words that our guy is actually using consistently and consistently gets reelected. No, it actually is a big thing if he didn't get reelected again, because that's one more layer shaved off of the garbage people I keep going to because of this particular segment that we have had in our society. We've had tons more before that are openly about it. We have to get rid of the last few left.
Yeah.
And there's more than a few.
Yeah, and then so all of that, and then when he gets the most minor consequence, a censure from the House, which we remember and you will remember, but 99% of the country never knew that it happened and will never think about it again. As consequences for actions go, that's a pretty light one. After just that, he is the same as the killed Lord and Savior of billions of people. He has suffered as they have. And the thing is, like, it would be one thing if you believe, I'm gonna try to be respectful. Jesus is an interesting guy with some interesting ideas. I don't personally believe that he is divine in any fashion, but he does. Steve King does believe that. And you have supposedly the words of this person, a person who is perfectly moral and all of that and has directly given you lessons. And even just, you have a book, you could just read that book and know what this guy wants. You've spent decades since I started to put together a timeline, and then I realized there's no way we'd be able to go through all this. Like, years spent trying to make English the official language of America, suing the Secretary of State for making voting information available in Laotian and Bosnian. On the House floor, he designated a model of a 12-foot concrete border wall topped with electrified wire, back when that was even crazier than it is now. Would Jesus try to electrify people passing into this country, and then himself make the comparison to cattle, which is what Steve King did? I mean, talking about where did any other subgroup of people contribute more to civilization, talking about white people? I mean, the constantly like talking up that book, The Camp of the Saints, which is like a murder fantasy of killing migrants crossing over into Europe. We could go on and on and on. You know what? It's time. It's time. We'll talk more, but it's time. For all that he has said and done, and now especially for trying to compare himself to Jesus, a guy who, whether fictionally or in real life, suffered more than really anyone else. No, you belong in the trash. Sorry, buddy. Steve King, garbage person. He really is the worst.
I can't. So, okay, so if you sit in that room and you're supportive of his and you do love Jesus, you have to eventually, the number of people who keep comparing themselves to the divine, to the infallible, you continue to do it, but when they say it to your face, you're supposed to get offended. Mm. That's your Lord and Savior.
Yeah.
This guy.
No, but they were in for it. They know who he is. The people who are still showing up to a Steve King town hall, they know exactly who he is.
But he's nothing like who he's comparing himself to. There's only one Christ, right? How is there so many other guys who are taking his place on the cross? Suddenly they're all just the same. I don't know how that works. You're supposed to get upset. Nobody reads, nobody figures out what it is. I grew up in the church. Every time I was 7 years old and I said, how is this pastor comparing himself to Jesus? This is a little weird. I love Jesus.
Exactly. But at least in that case, and I apologize, this is really getting to me. At least in that case, it's a pastor. Like, this is a politician. This is a guy who wanted political power so bad that he made it his career. Said a lot of terrible things, tried to do a lot of terrible things, but still wants to have that mantle of not just being a Christian, but having religious authority. That is what he's declaring to these people.
The Passion of John Iadarola.
The Passion of John Iadarola. I am basically Jesus. Okay. JR, thank you as always for joining us.
Check for the marks
show.
On the wrist.
Exactly. Stigmata on John Iadarola. Thank you, everybody, for watching. We'll see you tomorrow morning with more for you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Iadarola. I'll see you soon.